From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. Stocks around the world rebounded on news of Europe's long-awaited debt crisis deal, but analysts say lasting stability will depend on successful implementation. Muammar Gaddafi's son reportedly wants to turn himself into the Hague War Crimes Court. The U.S. withdrew its ambassador to Syria due to security risks, but expects him to return there next month. Yemeni women burn their veils to protest crackdowns on anti-government demonstrations, and the U.N. predicts the world's population will soon hit 7 billion people. The Friday News Roundup after this update.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The Commerce Department says consumer spending is up 0.6%, but after-tax incomes dropped a bit in September. So economist Scott Brown with Raymond James says that means Americans were dipping into savings to support their spending, and that cannot go on indefinitely.
Taken at face value, it's a bit of a mixed bag. It's nice that consumer spending is hanging in there. The bad news is we'd really like to see much better job growth and wage income growth to keep that going.
Consumer spending accounts for about 70% of economic activity in the U.S. A judge in Nashville has ordered the release of more than two dozen protesters who were arrested before dawn this morning for refusing to leave an area near the state capitol building, where they've been camping for 2 weeks now.
The whole world is watching! The whole world!
Demonstration is in support of the Occupy Wall Street movement. Kevin Vanderbrain says he and other protesters were given little time to clear out.
Cops gave us 10 minutes to comply. After that 10 minutes, they moved in.
Protests are now reportedly marching back to the area where they were arrested earlier this morning. The U.S. attorney in West Virginia says prosecutors are considering more charges related to last year's deadly coal mine explosion there. NPR's Howard Berkus reports the U.S. attorney says in a newspaper interview that prosecutors are looking at ways to charge officials with Massey Energy, the owner of the mine.
In a rare interview, U.S. Attorney Booth Goodwin told the Charleston Gazette that critics of the 18-month-long criminal probe should not assume that higher-level officials at Massey Energy won't be charged. So far, prosecutors have convicted a foreman and the mine's former security chief, but neither face charges directly related to the explosion. Goodwin told the Gazette prosecutors are considering an unprecedented approach, charging more senior Massey Energy officials for conspiracy to violate mine safety law. It hasn't been in the playbook, Goodwin said, but we're not operating under the prior playbook. Coal mine disasters rarely result in charges against high-level officials. Howard Berkus, NPR News.
Demonstrators are gathering in Pakistan to protest CIA drone attacks that target Islamist extremists. NPR's Julie McCarthy has more.
Critics of the drone program have conceded that the targeting of the missile attacks has become more precise, but independent verification is virtually impossible as Pakistan's tribal belt is off limits to any outsiders. The U.S. has intensified drone strikes against pro-Afghan Taliban militants based in North Waziristan. Military sources say that an attack there Thursday killed fighters related to the Pakistan Taliban commander Mullah Nazir, who is believed to be allied with the Haqqani network. It's blamed for attacking American installations and NATO forces in Afghanistan. Pakistan's reluctance to squeeze the Haqqani network operating on its soil has seriously strained relations with the United States.
This is NPR News. A NASA satellite is in orbit after a successful launch before dawn this morning from the Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. The satellite, which is about the size of an SUV, is designed to gather data to help improve weather forecasts and monitor climate change. Mary Glacken is with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
It's going to help us do many things beyond weather, including tracking ash plumes for volcanic eruptions, helping emergency responders fight wildfires, and measure Arctic sea ice and changes in the ozone level.
The satellite was originally supposed to be launched 5 years ago, but there were problems with development of several of its instruments. Britain has been given approval to change the laws on royal succession to permit both gender and religious equality when it comes to assuming the throne. Larry Miller reports there was a sense of urgency to change the rules in case the firstborn child to Prince William and his wife Catherine is a girl.
If there had been equality laws in the 1500s, there wouldn't have been Henry VIII. His older sister would have been Britain's monarch. The Reformation might not have happened, and European history would have been very different. Finally, the law of succession is about to change to give the firstborn child of the reigning monarch, boy or girl, equal rights to the throne. The British Commonwealth approved this change after personal appeals by the Queen and Prime Minister David Cameron.
The idea that a younger son should become monarch instead of an elder daughter, this way of thinking is at odds with the modern countries that we've all become.
Also scrapped, the ban on a monarch marrying a Roman Catholic. For NPR News, I'm Larry Miller in London.
Wall Street stock prices are mixed. The Dow is up 4 points. The Nasdaq is down 2. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the German Embassy, honoring German language students and their teachers at high schools and colleges across America. More information at germany.info.
Joining us, I'm Diane Rehm. Europe agreed to a new debt plan which sent global markets soaring. Former Libyan President Muammar Gaddafi was buried as NATO announced the end of its operations there, closing another chapter in the country's bloody history. And the world population is set to hit 7 billion people. Joining me in the studio to talk about the week's top international stories on the Friday News Roundup, Mark Landler of the New York Times, Susan Glasser of Foreign Policy Magazine, and Hisham Mellem of Al Arabiya. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning, all.
Good morning. Good morning, Diane.
Mark Landler, start by telling us about the plan to help Greece and other countries get out of this debt crisis.
Well, Diane, after weeks and weeks of frustrating negotiations and an all-night session on Thursday, Europe's leaders agreed on the outlines of a grand plan. And the heart of the plan is a voluntary agreement with banks to accept a 50% write-down on the Greek debt that they hold. This was a vital step because without a write-down and an acknowledgement that Greece couldn't pay back this money, you risked having what they call a disorderly default, which could have prompted a credit crisis similar to what we had in the United States a few years ago with the collapse of Lehman Brothers. So that was kind of the nightmare scenario that the Europeans were desperate to avoid. There were two other elements to it. One was a commitment to double the size of a stabilization fund, in effect a bailout fund, that the Europeans want to put in place as a sort of a firewall to prevent other countries from potentially going into crisis, Italy being the one that people are most worried about. And then lastly, a commitment to recapitalize the European banks. There are a host of questions around all the parts of this plan. Details are lacking. There's still a fundamental question about whether the Europeans and mostly the Germans have the political will to do what it takes. The numbers people are talking about are extraordinary, $1.4 trillion at least to erect the kind of firewall that will save Europe. And so a good week, but not by any means a drama that's finished.
And that's the question. Where's the money coming from?
Well, I think that's right. You know, all year, the politics of Europe have really been exploding over this very question, which is to say, is the North, is the, you know, sort of industrialized heartland of Europe, Germany, but also France, going to continue to accept a Eurozone situation in which they're paying for the lifestyle and the bad budgeting and accounting choices of their neighbors to the south? The fissures that have erupted in the Eurozone, I don't think are any closer to resolution. If anything, you could argue that this deal puts so much pressure on a very, you know, sort of unstable foundation of the Eurozone that it may potentially lead us to having a discussion over the next year or two as the consequences of it become clear about the future of the Eurozone, whether it's going to splinter apart.
And Hisham, aren't people going to China for a fair amount of the money, for example, to recapitalize?
Isn't everybody going to China?
Everybody.
You know, we were on the verge of a Greek tragedy. Now, we may be having a Greek drama. And I'm not sure whether the Eurozone is safe. I mean, just think of what Sarkozy said. He expressed regret that Greece was admitted. And he's absolutely right. I mean, the expansion of the Eurozone was ill-advised the way the expansion of NATO after the fall of the Soviet Union was ill-advised. And I think, yes, we may talk about Europe, but Europe also is not united. And I was in the summer in Northern Europe, and they don't want to have anything to do with the Eurozone. I mean, if you live in Sweden, you just don't want it. And I think, I'm not sure now, Greece will implement everything that is expected of Greece to implement, because this is going to require not only economic structural changes, it's going to require societal and cultural changes. People in Greece, like people in Lebanon, like many people in America, don't want to pay taxes. They want to enjoy living in a modern society with all the perks, healthcare and whatnot, but they don't want to pay taxes, and they're not producing enough kids, speaking of population.
And yet the U.S. seemed fairly happy with the outcome, Mark.
Well, the U.S. has a simple issue. Europe is one of our larger trading partners, and a credit crisis in Europe is almost bound to hit us hard at a time when our economy, notwithstanding some relatively better news this week, is still very close to a double-dip recession. So for President Obama, this has, you know, a very tangible domestic political implication. What's interesting about the U.S. is we don't have a lot to really offer the Europeans. We don't have money to bail them out, nor do we really have an economic track record for them to emulate. So when Tim Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, goes to Europe and lectures them about recapitalizing their banks or building firewalls, some European finance ministers react by saying, don't tell us how to fix our house. You haven't fixed your own yet.
Susan.
Well, I keep coming back to this term firewall, which, you know, again, is a term of optimism, it seems to me, rather than one of fact when it comes to what you can do to stop a crisis from spreading at a globalized moment when, as we saw with the United States bubble bursting, there was no firewall that protected Europe or the rest of the world from the consequences of that. And I think vice versa. You have President Obama today writing an op-ed in the Financial Times, pressing and in a way lecturing his European colleagues about the need for the bailout plan to include such a firewall. I think it's one of those vaguely reassuring terms to people, as if there was such a thing that one could construct. But I'm not sure that it bows to the basic economics of the situation, which is to say they're completely interdependent at this point, in particular Europe and the United States.
And yet you saw the stock markets all across Europe, Asia, and the United States jump dramatically, Hisham.
Yeah. Look, the international financial system is still brittle, and investors wanted to see a sign of hope, a ray of hope, even if it's not based on concrete results. As Mark said, there are a lot of details that are still, you know, waiting to be hammered out. But people were waiting for a ray of hope, because this Eurozone crisis has been dragging on for a long time. And the Greeks did not deliver on the promises. And there is real concern about Italy, which is the third largest economy in the Eurozone. So, but to go back to what Susan was saying, not only the Europeans are chastising the United States, the Chinese are chastising Tim Geithner and the president because we are not showing fiscal responsibility.
Mark.
You know, there's a more profound issue that the Europeans have to wrestle with, which is that when they created a monetary union, They left budget and fiscal policy in the hands of the countries. That set up what's basically an irreconcilable conflict. It allows the Greeks to be profligate while the Germans are cautious, but lashes everybody to the same currency. And I think there's a recognition that if they're going to save the euro, they really need to push further toward a genuine fiscal and even political union. So in an odd way, this is raising the most basic question about the nature of Europe going forward, which is why I think it's fair to say not only is it early in the drama, but some of the most momentous moments are probably still to come.
Mark Landler, White House correspondent for The New York Times. Susan Glasser, editor-in-chief of Foreign Policy magazine. Hisham Elam, Washington bureau chief of Al Arabiya News Channel. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Colonel Gaddafi was buried on Tuesday in an anonymous grave. Do the Libyans continue to see him as a threat, dead or alive? Susan.
Well, it's been a pretty extraordinary week, I think, in many ways, as we've begun to think about what does post-revolution Libya look like. And one of the things we were just talking about was the question of how has this fledgling new government handled the challenge of the killing, the very public, bloody, videotaped killing of Colonel Gaddafi, and the conflicting statements about it that we heard early on. Should this cause us to question whether the militias that have been unleashed in the revolution are really under the control of the transitional government? They've now come out and said there will be an investigation of Colonel Gaddafi's killing after days of insisting that he had somehow merely been caught in crossfire, a story that didn't really hold up under the overwhelming weight of the visual testimony that was being released. You know, these tools make it impossible, really, to do something like shoot your former leader in cold blood with no one noticing.
Mark.
Well, and there's a sort of an unresolved strand to the story, which is the fate of Saif al-Islam, Gaddafi, one of Gaddafi's sons, one who survived, at least we believe, until now, and is in hiding. There's talk of him trying to cut a deal with the International Criminal Court in which he might turn himself in and go to The Hague. He might view that as the safest possible outcome given what happened to his father and his brother. The reports are very sketchy, so we don't really know. There's also reports that he's under the care of mercenaries who might be trying to arrange safe passage to a country that doesn't recognize the criminal court, say Zimbabwe. So there's still that piece of the story yet to be resolved.
What happened to the rest of Gaddafi loyalists who were with him or around him at the time of his killing?
I think the loyalists have been dealt a decisive defeat. I mean, you may find a few here and there, maybe some members of his tribe, but essentially Gaddafi's era is over, and it ended violently in his killing. But what is more disturbing now are the political development that occurred immediately after. The way the council or the interim government handled the killing of Gaddafi, the investigation, and also the speech that was given by Mustafa
Al-Najjar. And now declaring Sharia law.
Yeah, I'm going to talk. Yeah, if you give me a chance to talk about
it. And Hisham Elam is with Al Arabiya News Channel. Short break. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
And I'd like to go back to Libya, Hisham, because NATO has announced it's ending operations there, even though the interim government was hoping they'd stay.
Look, I think the ending NATO's mission is the correct thing to do. And obviously, NATO's role was decisive. One could argue that without NATO, Gaddafi would have succeeded in crushing the what was initially a peaceful uprising. But let me talk a little bit about what happened after Gaddafi. Now, there were many stories about how he was killed. They were not credible when the government claimed that he was killed in a crossfire, when everybody, witnesses, Libyans and international citizens who were there, said otherwise. They should have said, we don't know exactly what happened, but we will promise a thorough, transparent investigation, period. And that's it. They didn't do that. That was the first stumble, first mistake. To me, politically, what was worse was the speech given by Mustafa Abdel Jalil, the head of the Libyan Transitional Council. He spoke extemporaneously in a historic moment, and he talked about things that was really surprising. Instead of talking about demobilizing the militias, instead of talking about an interim government that would prepare for election and writing a new modern constitution, he talked about Sharia. He talked about the primacy of Sharia in the new constitution. He talked about we're going to allow polygamy again and Islamic banking. Now, I heard the whole speech, and then I went back and heard the speech that was given by King Idris 60 years ago on the occasion of Libya's independence. Now, this was a Sanusi who belongs to a religious Sufi order. He was you would expect him to be pious Muslim. The king was less Muslim than Abdel Jalil. The king spoke politically about a new constitution, about, you know, and yet Abdel Jalil is talking about Sharia as if people fought and died for polygamy.
Mark.
We had an op-ed piece a couple of days ago that Susan and I were actually talking about just before the show, which I thought was very provocative, by British historian Simon Montefiore. And he basically offered a tour of the of world history and how dictators meet their ends. And it's a, you know, it's a catalog of atrocities of people being torn from limb to limb or hung upside down. And he made a sort of an interesting point about Gaddafi, which goes to this issue of how was he killed and what are the responsibilities of the new government in getting to the bottom of it. And whatever you believe about those issues, he basically said that tyrants meet their end in the way that they've created the regime and the culture of the country. And there's one particularly interesting line where Montefiore says, when Gaddafi asked his frenzied killers who had known no other rulers in their life, do you not know the difference between right and wrong? He had already taught them the answer. It was a column that got a great deal of response in our newspaper. And it made just an interesting point about the brutal facts of someone who's ruled a country in a certain way for 42 years and how perhaps there was no other ending for someone like him.
And Susan, what about a timetable for a new government and new parliament? Seems awfully ambitious.
Not only does it seem ambitious, but I think I go back to the official ending of the NATO involvement in Libya with zero sense of what the world is going to offer. We're so quick, and our world leaders from Sarkozy to Barack Obama are so quick to take the podium and announce their role in the success of toppling this bloody dictator. What's the assistance that the world is going to give to these people? Where are the partners who are going to advance a new pluralistic, democratic Libyan government? What about demobilization? What about building a new constitution? We have heard nothing from Western governments whatsoever about any positive role. It's like, okay, you're on your own. We've dropped a few tons of ordnance on you. We spent $1 billion in the case of the United States to get rid of your tyrant, and good luck to you folks.
All right. So you're talking about intellectual assistance, but surely Libya has the dollars.
Well, certainly they have the finances to rebuild, right. But they don't necessarily have any of the capacity. So I'm not just talking about moral assistance. I'm talking about where is a plan to put some kind of international assistance on the ground, actually, to help them, whether it's in the basics of building a legal system, which we just talked about. Libya has been ruled for 42 years by a very particular and quirky form of one-man rule. And so they don't have the institutions that would be required to have this kind of transition.
Hisham.
Politically, Libya is a wasteland. I mean, it's a country bereft of any kind of institutions, political, economic, judicial.
That.
Exactly. It was a one-man rule, yeah. And it was a comical, you know, bizarre rule anyway. But they have no legal infrastructure. If they had caught Gaddafi alive, they could not put him on trial in 5 years because they don't have a judicial system to speak of. They don't have independent judiciary, none of this. They don't have this kind of civil societies that you and I understand in a modern state. They don't have political parties to talk about. There are political trends, maybe the Islamists and others, but we are talking about a country that was pulverized by this man for the last 42 years. So anybody who is going to expect a transformation from this state of affairs into a more representative, democratic form of government will probably be disappointed. The transition is going to be extremely complicated. In Tunisia, it's going to be much better. In Egypt, probably less. But in Libya, it is going to be monumental and extremely difficult.
Mark.
I thought it was telling that the death of Gaddafi happened a day before President Obama announced the return of the final troops from Iraq, because I think it speaks to a profound weariness on the part of the United States about just the kind of help that Susan and Hisham are talking about. Libya needs it. So does Tunisia. So does Egypt. Our country and the Europeans, for reasons that we've talked about earlier, are not in the kind of mental frame, nor do they have the kind of resources they once did to undertake these efforts.
And now we have the U.S. ambassador to Syria recalled and Syria recalled its ambassador here to the U.S. Tell me what's going on, Susan.
Well, you know, I'm so glad we turned back to Syria and the rest of the Arab world, because Libya in some ways has been, distracting, I think, from the much broader set of struggles that are going on. And obviously, there's been a very bloody crackdown. I believe the latest UN count has it several thousand people have been killed in Syria as they have tried to suppress the protests that broke out in the wake of the Arab Spring. The U.S. ambassador there has played a very aggressive role. He's publicly gone and shown solidarity with activists. He's actually been tweeting and using any tool that he could figure. It's a very murky story.
And rather unusual for
Absolutely.
U.S. ambassador to take on that kind of stance.
I agree with that. I think it's been a very public and unusually in-your-face approach. And in a way, it speaks to the lack of other tools that are available to them. It's been pretty clear since the outset of the Libyan intervention that that option was not really on the table with Syria, although you do see their next-door neighbor and longtime partner, Turkey, taking an interesting lead in trying to support not only the nonviolent protesters, but even some of those defectors from the Syrian army who've pledged violent resistance.
Providing shelter to them.
Well, that's right. On the front page of the Times today is a very interesting account of all the many ways in which Turkey, including providing shelter to the armed resistance in Syria, is going. But, you know, I wanted to go back just to the big picture view. Earlier this week, it was the 70th anniversary of the Freedom House, which is an American organization that was founded to provide democracy assistance, in effect. It was co-founded by Eleanor Roosevelt and Wendell Willkie. And, you know, a young woman from Bahrain, a young Bahraini journalist, came and she was presenting one of the awards. And she literally had this jaded Washington audience in tears as she talked about the forgotten freedom struggle, you know, that she and other young, Western-oriented, liberal-minded Bahraini, not just journalists, but students and people all across the board have been undertaking. In a way, the Libyan story has distracted us from—there's not— one narrative of the American involvement here. And it's much more uncomfortable for us to look at Bahrain, where we have not supported the democracy protesters in the way that people here in the United States, it's sort of out of sight, out of mind. And it's a lot easier than paying attention to that more complicated situation.
And think about the Yemeni women burning their veils. What a sight, Mark.
Yeah, and it goes very directly to what Susan was just saying about the uncomfortable questions for the United States. This moment came with women burning their veils, a very symbolic thing. The first time they'd done it in all the months of protest in Yemen, and it was an act of defiance against the government, particularly for brutalizing women and children in the crackdown on protests there. But look at the situation in Yemen. You had President Saleh, who narrowly missed being killed in a bombing, leave the country to Saudi Arabia, recover from his wounds, go back to Yemen, where he now sits still in the presidency. He called in the U.S. ambassador this week and said he would abide by the terms of a deal he'd struck with other Gulf countries to have a gradual transition. But no one took this seriously, given his track record and given the important role of Saudi Arabia and the U.S.'s counterterrorism cooperation with Yemen, most recently in the assassination of Anwar al-Awlaki. This is another country like Bahrain where the U.S. has a complex relationship and is balancing values against strategic considerations, and it goes to the complexity that Susan was talking about earlier.
And in all of these discussions underlying them, is the growth in population around the world staggering? 7.1 billion as of Monday.
Well, Susan. And you know, it directly connects up to this story. Sana'a, the capital of Yemen, is one of the world's fastest growing cities, actually. It's in the top 10. And I think it's a good reminder of the future instability that we may see as a result of demographic pressures. Yemen is running out of water. It's running out of the oil that's fueled its economy. It's bursting with people, and it's more and more unstable as a result.
Well, and one other point to make about population that actually I think links into this week's news, it's a lopsided pattern around the world. You have countries in South Asia and Africa that are growing explosively, countries in Europe and Japan that are growing hardly at all, or in some cases shrinking, and more importantly, aging. So that when you talk about the efforts to bail out Greece and Italy, that happens against a backdrop of aging societies with fewer young people to join the labor force, having to support a population that's growing old, has depended and relied on generous social safety nets for decades. So this raises all kinds of issues for how the Europeans confront their problems, let alone all the issues of how these parts of the world deal with so many new people.
Mark Landler of the New York Times, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And we'll open the phones now. 800-433-8850. Let's go to Middletown, Connecticut. Good morning, Lena.
Yes, good morning, Diane. Few government or religious leaders are addressing overpopulation and the eventual shortage of resources and food, especially in third world countries. I blame Christianity for much of this problem, and I'll give you a personal example. My brother and his wife are evangelical missionaries in Africa. Part of their mission is to convince women that birth control is against God. So is one to believe that God wants poor women in third world countries to have 8 or 10 children, only to see many of them starve to death? But then without pictures of starving babies on television, how would these religious groups get most of their donations?
Now, it's interesting. Here in this country, Mississippi is attempting to enact a new law that would define birth at time of conception. It goes to this question of birth control. It goes to the question of how do we think about population in this world, Susan?
Well, you know, I'm going to say something a little counterintuitive, perhaps, which is to say that we've run a few articles in Foreign Policy making the argument that while certainly this is a present-day controversy, there's no question if you look at the food crisis, the skyrocketing prices for resources
and water,
and water in particular, but also grain prices, buying up of land, for example, by the Chinese in Africa in order to secure a bigger food supply. These are very real present-day crises. The flip side is, demographically speaking, what's actually an important new trend is that family sizes are shrinking most rapidly in some of the developing countries. For example, Iran. Of course, we all know about China and its population control methods. You know what that means is that actually after mid-century, when, you know, the population is going to go from 7 billion, it's projected to go up to 9 and possibly even 11 billion. However, demographers are saying that after the mid-century, you could even see it topping out. You could see a real crisis of aging in these developing societies that haven't had time to get rich first, like Europe and the United States. Iran has one of the fastest dropping rates of childbirth in the world. And so I think you really have to be prepared for sort of a mind scramble, which is to say, yes, we have on the one hand a population crisis and exploding demand for resources. On the other hand, we have to look ahead and anticipate what's going to happen in these much poorer societies in the world when they age rapidly and they don't have as many children to take care of them and they don't have the benefits of a youth bulge, which provides economic growth.
Hisham.
It's true that this is a very crowded neighborhood now, but I think many demographers would say that you can have sustainable economic growth and even with 7 and probably in 13 years, 8 billion, because, you know, every 12 years now we have an additional billion. But I mean, looking at the other trends, as Mark and Susan said, they are conflicting trends. You have the Chinese now, by the way, notwithstanding their enforced, you know, policy, they're going to have a serious problem having enough young people paying money so that they will take care of a huge aging strata of people.
What about here in the United States?
Yeah, in the United States, we're much better than Europe because we are still we should maintain our open doors policy in terms of immigration, and that's why we benefited a lot. The Europeans are having problems with that too. We have an aging population in Italy and other places where they will have serious problems in providing for medical care and social security for the aging population. In the United States, we have escaped that, and I think if we maintain that open door policy when it comes to immigration, we will probably escape it in the next generation or two.
Mark.
A few interesting things I noticed in the context of the 7 billion milestone. The Chinese are saying that their one child policy prevented 400 million births, and that in the absence of the one child policy, we would have hit the 7 billion several years earlier than now.
Mark Landler, The New York Times. Short break, and we'll be right back.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by ESAT, offering business network protection from viruses, hackers, spam, and cyber threats. ESET.com. By the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working to transform nursing to meet the needs of patients now and in the future at thefutureofnursing.org. By the Gilchrist Foundation, in support of NPR's commitment to coverage of the arts. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR.
To protect the life of a dog who is being abused, the hero of Scott Spencer's novel, Man in the Woods, gets into a fight and accidentally kills the man abusing the dog. In shock, he thinks,
how can this be happening? And he wishes, suddenly, fervently, that there was a God.
We'll hear from Scott Spencer on the next Fresh Air.
And it's time to go to the phones, 800-433-8850. First to Boynton Beach, Florida. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. Diane, I am sort of perplexed because I haven't heard anything in the news about what monies and diamonds and certificates and so forth that Gaddafi would have had with him. That man would never have been out with no funds with him, you know?
What about that, Mark?
Well, you're probably the caller is, I'm sure, right that he wouldn't be out without anything. But in fact, there had been reports earlier of rebel forces coming across hiding places that Gaddafi had, where there were, you know, some signs of wealth, although no huge treasure chests that they came across. So no doubt there'll be a huge forensic exercise to figure out where he stashed his money, and that's probably been underway for the past 3 months, and we may know more about it than we did at the beginning of this process.
What about safe and the monies he might have, Susan?
Well, you know, listen, it's all speculation at this point, but let's also remember that Gaddafi was dragged out of a drain pipe. And, you know, we've all seen these unfortunate pictures now. And so, you know, maybe he had some money that he was carrying on him. But, you know, in the end, there might have been something in his vehicle. But, you know, he was captured alone and in a drain pipe with a small guard around him.
To Charlotte, North Carolina. Good morning, Frank.
Oh, hi. I have a question and a comment. Okay, the president announced that he was going to pull all troops out of Iraq by the end of the year. And I would like to know what you people thought about how we made our lives or the Iraqi people's lives any better. And my comment is that last week you talked about the trading of 1,000 Palestinians for one Israeli soldier. But according to Defense for Children International, okay, the Israelis are not prosecuted for violence against the Palestinian people. And if they were prosecuted, you would have an even trade.
All right. Thanks for calling. What have we accomplished in Iraq?
Well, we helped the Iraq. Well, we got rid of a brutal dictator. I mean, that's one sort of indisputable fact about what happened in Iraq. And the country now has a functioning, if very flawed, political system. They have parties. They have elections. They have, as American officials love to say, they have actual politics in that country. But obviously the caller raises a profound question about what an 8-year war accomplished in other respects. And the track record there is open to a lot of debate.
Hey, sure.
I think this was the longest unnecessary war in American history. And Mark is right. Maybe we know maybe in 25 years when we ask that question, if we have real politics in Iraq, if we have a stable government where basic human rights are respected, one could argue that the losses, the American losses, and the horrendous Iraqi losses would have been justified. But at this stage, I would have to tell you that when the United States leaves at the end of this year, it will not be the United States, the country, the outside country with the most influence in Iraq. Iraq's future now is being shaped and influenced by two regional powers. One of them is anti-American, which is Iran, and the other one is Turkey. So after 8 years, after 5,000 men and women lost, 32,000 wounded, half of them seriously, tens of thousands of Iraqis lost, we have this situation, which is extremely murky, where sectarianism rules Iraq today. And Iran and Turkey are competing to shape the future of that country.
All right, to Cincinnati, Ohio. Hi there, Drew.
Good morning, Diane. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you.
My question for you and the panel is if we should really take any, you know, weight into the recent stock market rise from the European deal being approved.
Susan.
And the reason I ask this is because more and more to me and, you know, many others I speak with is that the market, in a way, seems to operate off hearsay. You know, we'll hear good news, you know, from the media, you know, the agglomeration of our sources, you know. And right now, the general, you know, consensus is that, yeah, it's good news that there's been compromise. However, do you think that at the very first sign of the deal not working out, that stocks will once again plummet? And if so, when should we really take, you know, solid hold of information that, you know, the stocks are improving or, you know, once again going to plummet? How do we know really what's going to happen.
You have to have a crystal ball, Susan.
That's right. I was going to say I left my magic eight ball at home, so I can't pronounce on how when we're going to know the market for sure. That being said, I think the caller raises a really important point. Right now, clearly, it's early days for Europe and its recovery. If you look at the situation, in some ways, it reminds me of the resolution, quote unquote, of the American debt crisis this summer by Congress. What happened? Well, we put it off. That's what political systems do when they're in crisis and there's only so much they can handle. There are some dates that kick some key decisions into the future for the European Stability Fund. I believe next June is going to be another critical date. And I think that you're going to see this keep going in waves and with incremental solutions that are represent the best deal that the politicians who ultimately are running the show again are going to be able to get. So in the end, this was a political deal forged by German Chancellor Angela Merkel and the French President Nicolas Sarkozy. They're politicians. They're not economists. And this is the best political deal they were able to get today. The markets will forget about it in a while, and we'll see next spring and next summer whether it was a lasting deal.
All right. To Kensington, Maryland. Good morning, Louise. You're on the air.
Good morning, Ed. I read someplace that in the year 2000, the Greek government asked an American company, I think it was Goldman Sachs, to produce a set of accounting books so that they would be accepted into a European Union. It seems like the books were cooked to produce a rosy scenario. And then, obviously, Goldman Sachs and others in the U.S. lend the Greeks tons of money in the forms of whatever securities they had. If this is true, is there any chance that we can find out exactly what illegalities they might have committed? Thank you.
Mark.
Well, this question of whether Greece cooked its books to get in is one that's been around for years. And it is true that the European Union, and particularly the monetary union, was a triumph of hope over experience. A lot of people made leaps. As to the question of whether we'll get to the bottom of it, I guess I'd be a little bit skeptical that we'll ever pursue this as a criminal case. But, you know, there's no question that countries like Greece, Portugal, Spain to some extent, and Italy made pledges based on numbers that were not realistic at the time and certainly not sustainable given the politics of those countries. And that was probably most egregious in the case of Greece.
What do you think, Hisham? Are we ever going to find out exactly what happened to get Greece into the EU?
I mean, the Greeks were very eager to join the EU for a variety of reasons. Everybody wants to join that club. But you don't have to be, you know, an economist when you look at a country that functions like Greece. And with all due respect, I studied Greek philosophy, and I'm a great admirer of Greek tradition. But Greece, in many ways, is a Middle Eastern country. They want to live in a European country in terms of enjoying the services of an advanced European society, social security, early retirement. But there is also a tradition of avoiding taxes, and we've seen incredible stories about how the elite in Greece try to avoid paying taxes. I mean, it's not like here we hire a lawyer to do that, but they violate the law in Greece, and they have strong unions, they have strong labor movement, they have an anarchist movement, and they just don't want to sacrifice, especially in terms of paying taxes and regulations and whatnot. And yet they want to enjoy the fruits of a welfare state. You cannot have it both ways. And Greece did not really have the kind of leadership that would force people to make hard decisions. Europe, all Europe is lacking in terms of leadership. Merkel is the only one, really, because she has a great economy.
And there was that photograph of Merkel in the midst of all these men as though she really was.
Rock of Gibraltar.
Absolutely.
You know, I saw that this morning too, yeah. Diane, and I thought it just leapt out at you, right? You know,
right.
she's something very unique. She's been dumped on all year. You know, it's been said that, you know, she didn't have the political support at home, that she didn't have the will, that she wasn't really a supporter of the European project to begin with, that she didn't have the economic background because she came from East Germany.
Wonder who was reporting all those
Well,
things.
And you know what? And it's been dumped right in her lap. And the answer is that if you want to know what's going to happen to you right now, if it weren't for Merkel, you wouldn't even be taking the halting steps that you did have. That doesn't mean, you know, this is a crisis not of her choosing, but the solution will come a bit from her making.
All right. To Jacksonville, North Carolina. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Just very quickly, I have no political affiliation at all, but I tend to be very conservative. I was in the Marine Corps, and I just retired as a naval physician after 22 years. I spent a long time in the Middle East with trauma units, and we took care of insurgents and anyone, regardless of where they came from. And I wanted to, I know that the way Gaddafi was brutalized and those images were, I think, horrifying to Americans, but I wanted to express alarm that more Americans weren't concerned about the fact that our own Secretary of State had been in Tripoli weeks before that, stating that Gaddafi should either be captured or killed, and then our own president seemed to be reveling in the fact that this had happened. I think Saddam Hussein had the good fortune to be captured by Americans, and I think it's a great deviation from American tradition, and I'll take your comments on the air.
All right. Thanks.
Well, one thing that I reported on this past week is the internal deliberations that went on in the administration about what to do if Gaddafi were captured alive. It was a subject that came up 2 days before he was killed between Secretary of State Clinton and the transitional leaders in Libya. And it was a deeply, deeply complicated question because there were doubts on the American side about whether the Libyans had the capacity to conduct a fair trial at home. There was also a reluctance to push them to say, you've got to send him to The Hague, because that would appear to be encroaching on the sovereignty of a country that's newly born. Likewise, within the Transitional National Council, the leadership in Libya, there were the same splits between people that wanted to put him on trial in the country, people who wanted to put him on trial outside the country, turn him over, and then some contingent that would rather have nothing to do with the whole process, would probably have preferred the outcome that happened. So it's a fair question to raise because for all concerned, this outcome, however ugly, avoided what would have been a very delicate situation.
Interesting. To Hollywood, Florida. Richard, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a question about the use of the word Sharia, because I think it does a lot of us disservice.
Are you there, Richard? Oh, dear. He must have dropped off. Hisham, explain very quickly for us Sharia law, and let me remind our listeners, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Explain to us.
Sharia law means really certain practices that came with the emergence of
for example, of
Islam. Punishment, severe punishment, for instance, theft, you know, cut off your hand. Sharia law does not give women any kind of equality when it comes to divorce and all sorts of things. Sharia is not practiced in most Muslim countries. There are a few countries, from Saudi Arabia to Pakistan, Iran, all that, Afghanistan, old Afghanistan. But Sharia law is not practiced throughout the Muslim world the way traditional interpretation of Sharia should be. What you have is many Muslim countries would argue that Sharia should be one of the sources of jurisprudence, but not necessarily the primary source. And that's why if you look at the Arab constitutions, they are very much influenced by European constitutions. And when it comes to, for instance, gender equality, this is a huge issue in the modern-day Arab world and the Muslim world. Sharia is not good for women. And that's why many people were raising their eyebrows when Mustafa Abdel Jalil was talking about polygamy and Sharia and all that as the primary or the primacy of Sharia in jurisprudence. And that's the problem.
Here's an email from Rod in McLean, Virginia, who says Gaddafi was killed in the heat of the capture. It's very hard to control events in a situation like that. Why can't the West just accept that?
Well, I mean, he has a point. I mean, look, we're talking about young men who've been fighting for 8-9 months, fighting a brutal dictator who, and probably they have people in their own families and their clans who've been killed or tortured or jailed or humiliated for most of their lives. So in that sense, we're talking about an undisciplined army. We're not talking about conventional armies here. And you can't compare the American army in Iraq with these young men in Libya. And go back to the point that Mark was trying to raise. If he was captured, whether they send him to the International Court of Criminal Court or whether they tried him in Libya, he will be hovering over the future of Libya for many years. And he will be a distraction, whether he is in Libya under trial or in jail or in Europe somewhere, you know, the International Criminal Court. And one should not be surprised. If you look at what happened to Mussolini, to Ceausescu, to all of these brutal dictators in the 20th century, that editorial in the op-ed piece in the New York Times was spot
right.
on. Absolutely.
Yeah.
It has the memorable quote from Winston Churchill, I think it is, in that piece about dictators who come to power riding a tiger,
yes.
and then they can never get off. And I think, you know, the tiger is what ate up Gaddafi this week. But David Reif called him the man who knew too much and said, you know, let's be realistic in the way that this caller points out, Western governments were probably happy on some level not to have Gaddafi on trial in The Hague and talking about his dealings with them, the oil money that went back and forth, their efforts to launder themselves into a new form of respectability over the last few years. Those would be very uncomfortable for governments from London to the United States.
What about Secretary of State Clinton's reaction to Gaddafi's death? Mark.
Oh, this was when she was handed the BlackBerry. Well, I mean, it was a dramatic moment. She was sitting, getting ready to tape an interview, was handed a BlackBerry, and reacted very cautiously because she wasn't sure yet whether it was actually true.
And then, didn't she laugh?
She said, "Wow."
She said, "Wow."
She said, "Wow." Yeah.
Mark Glandler, Susan Glasser, Hisham Mellon. Thank you all. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org. From Carnegie Corporation of New York, a foundation created to do what Andrew Carnegie called real and permanent good, celebrating 100 years of philanthropy. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. This is NPR.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, 50 years after its publication, the anti-war classic Catch-22 is still part of the American lexicon. The life and work of author Joseph Heller and why he said his defining novel was not his best.